Hey, folks, don't forget to get some of the new WTF cap merch at podswag.com/WTF. It's a new take on our original cap merch, this time featuring Buster and Sammy. But these shirts are in full color. Stickers, tank tops, mugs. Go get some swag. And some of the classic WTF merch is 30% off right now. So that's all at podswag.com/WTF or click merch at WTFpod.com. All right?
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucktopians? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. What's happening? What is happening? Are we okay? How's it going? What time is it? You guys got to go? You're going to hang out for a minute? How much time you got? You got a little bit? I got my friend Sovereign Sire is on the show today. I've known her for years. She's opened for me many times. She's funny. She's sharp. She's a writer. She's, I don't know how to, like, it's an interesting conversation to have because of the way people see porn. Like, how do you see porn? You know, it's a job. It's a job, and it's a specific type of entertainer. That's what I'd like to think of it as. It's a very specific type of entertainment. You got to be all in, you know, to do that type of entertaining. And but for the last year or so, she's been primarily OnlyFansing it. But she's been working on this pilot and working on this show idea with my old buddy Pete Berg, who's been on this show. And they've been fleshing it out. And she opened for me a couple weeks ago at Dynasty Typewriter. So, yeah, so this is it. I don't know how you feel about porn. I don't know where you're, you know, whether, you know, how do you frame it, man? I was brought up on old school porn. So I saw it too young. I judged myself against it. I've talked about this before many times. I don't necessarily think porn is great to see when you're 15 because then you're sort of like, you know, you've got a barometer by which to judge yourself and your sexual activity against. And it's, you know, I don't know if I've ever made the mark, but I don't know if that's important. Maybe I have. I don't know if it's, I guess what I'm saying is you should probably wait till you're a little older to take it in. Man, I do love telling that story though. I think it was traumatizing, but I put myself through it. And we used to go to the Naked Eye. Was that what it's called? Or the Pyramid? It was the Pyramid Theater. I think this is in one of my books. But I don't know. Maybe I feel like revisiting it. For you, me and my buddies, it's not a group of guy activity. You know, porn is a solo endeavor, really, unless you're watching it with your partner to get things started or you know, whatever. Hey, man, again, no judgies. But we used to have nothing to do. We had our fake IDs, and I just remember it must have been one time, maybe twice, because I remember it specifically. We went to this place. It was right off of Central near maybe Girard. It was the Pyramid Theater. Old school. It was late 70s, back when, you know, you didn't have the Betamaxes and people still had to go out into the world to do the porn thing. They had to go out to sit out in public in a theater to jerk off to porn. And that was what you did there, I guess. But we were just a bunch of drunk high school kids, and we got in. I just remembered you went around back, and there was a beaded curtain, and in the front of this place, before you got into the theater, there was something called live body painting. I don't know what was going on. I just know we were drunk, and we go into this fucking gross theater. And those theaters never really, especially the ones that weren't originally theaters, you know, the seats were in kind of weird places. The rows were bolted to the floor, kind of off. It didn't have a feeling like a movie theater. And I just remember, like, you know, it was me and Bob, David. I don't remember. I think there was one other dude. But I just remember the time we went there, there was like an old couple, like, you know, grandparents old, sitting in front of us. And Bob, you know, whispers to me, "My grandparents are here." And I remember laughing and drunken laughing. So then the movie starts, and this is like, I had seen, you know, photographic depictions of sex in porn, so I knew where everything went, but I hadn't seen much of the sort of live action stuff. And I've tracked this movie down. Again, I feel like I've told this story before, but it's okay, because this is one of the first times I experienced seeing sex, live action sex. And all I remember is a guy on a bus, gets off a bus in a town, meets a girl, a woman. She takes him home, and they're having sex. And tattooed on her stomach over her vagina is the face of the devil. And her vagina is sort of the beard and mouth of the devil. And he's having sex with her, and she's saying, "Fuck me, fuck the devil, fuck me, fuck the devil." And I was like, wow, so that's a lot to take in. And is this how it's going to be all the time? Or no, this is unique, right? This situation. And then, like, I just remember it ends with, it was a cult. There's a platform, and there's a bunch of people wearing, like, hooded uniform, like, hooded outfits, like druids, around this platform. And on the platform, there's a woman on all fours with a candle sticking out of her ass that's lit. And all the people around the table were chanting, "All hail Uranus, all hail Uranus." And I was like, all right, so this is what sex is. Fuck me, fuck the devil, all hail Uranus. Okay, good. I'm good. I got it. It's in my memory. Boy, is it burned in there. Burned into my fucking memory. But I feel bad talking all the porn talk, because Sav is getting out, man. She's getting out, and I hope she does, and I'm 100% behind her. She's funny. She's smart. She's writing. I did a read-through of this script that she's working on, trying to sell, and it's great. And I just, look, man, I'm not saying that porn is bad, but, you know, it's something that you should get out when you can, I think. Even if it's your choice, it doesn't seem like, you know, it seems like you do it for a while, you know what I'm saying? I haven't done it. Maybe I should look into it. Should I get into porn? I think it's too late. Isn't it too late for me to get into porn? Is there such thing as a DILF? There must be, right? Am I a... Come on. Stop it. Stop it. This is not about that. All right? Job is a job. Right? I mean, on some level, who doesn't get fucked at work? Am I right? This is me talking to my friend Sovereign Sire about her comedy, her writing, her attitudes about the adult sex work biz, and her life. How long have I known you?
Actually, I was going to say, I actually knew that we met in July. I don't know why I remembered that.
Really?
I have a memory like an elephant for shit. Mm. But for some reason, I remembered that we met in July. And
July 2014.
And I looked it up. It's like to the day almost.
Of today?
Of today.
Come on.
That we met.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, we were online friends for about like 6 months or so.
Right, then, but I can't. And then
you're like, "Do you want to have coffee?" And then that was in, and I like look, because I saw it in my Twitter DMs, yeah. And I was like, that we had been having these long conversations for a long time
about comedy.
Then, yeah, I think so. Just like whatever, just kind of just talking, and then and then it was like, so that was like around July, so
of 2014,
and then I came over and we had coffee. But I'd never listened to the podcast. I'd never listened to a podcast.
Yeah.
I hadn't listened to your podcast.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that your podcast was like important to people or whatever. And so you were showing me around your house.
Yeah.
And I always remember it because you took me into your podcast studio.
Into the garage.
And you're like a little kid that's just like really proud of their shit. You're like, and here's where the magic happens. And I'm just sitting there like,
okay,
that's really cool, Mark.
You have all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I was completely...
But I was trying to remember why. I mean, like I was trying to remember the beginning of it, because I didn't know your work,
but I knew for some reason you were connected to comedians or you wanted to do comedy. I don't remember. Like, I wasn't like, oh my God, it's the porn lady whose stuff I watch. It wasn't like that. I've had that happen before. I've seen porn people. Like, I knew years ago, I knew this. I used to tell that story on stage. Like, there was a couple of porn actresses I knew when I was a younger person from watching them, and mm-hmm. I saw one at the airport, and I did not know what to do, and I really wanted to say, you know, I really enjoy your work. But what is that? It's just like
it's awkward. Like, I don't think of myself as a public person per se, and certainly not famous. But yeah. At the same time, you know, if I go look up the stats on stuff like Pornhub,
yeah.
like 11 million plus people have watched my work. And
you can look up your stats on Pornhub?
I mean, a lot of those places will just tell you like how many views a performer has on the site.
And they'll tell anybody that?
Or, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And if I go and look around different tube sites and start doing the math, I'm that's a lot of eyeballs.
Yeah.
But
so you don't think of yourself as a public person, but you know a lot of people have seen you do stuff.
Yeah, and it's a different kind of celebrity because people don't come up to you, because if they come up to you and say hi, what they're also saying is, yeah. I've jacked off to you.
Well, no, that was
and now we're talking about you jacking off, right. And your jacking off habits, yeah. Which is, you know, really inappropriate.
I'm trying to arc the conversation because, you know, where we're at now, I mean, after you've been telling me you're going to get out of porn for at least 6 of the years I've known you.
Yeah.
That there is, this seems to be really happening. So I think it's sort of interesting to, you know, kind of go back. So the public person talking about jerking off, but the idea that it's a job, I think, is what people have a hard time with.
Yeah, they do.
You know, that like, you know, and we've sort of talked about it privately before, that on some level, because you're this fantasy object and you do that as a job, that you don't get, it's like you don't get respect from any quarter of the culture.
Well, I mean, it really is because, you know, someone will say, well, you're not a real actress. And I was like, well, you're watching the wrong performances.
Yeah.
And then that same person asked, like, how many of the orgasms in porn are real? And I said, 0%. 0% are real.
Wait,
so
really?
That, but it's like the same person was like, you're an amazing, you're like not a real actress.
Uh-huh.
And then turned around and asked how many of the orgasms in porn are real and was shocked to find out 0. And I was like, so I guess we actually are pretty very good actresses because here we are.
Because that question is eternal.
Well, and it's not to say that what's going on camera doesn't feel good, but I mean, the circumstances, if you've ever been with a woman, which I know you have, making a woman come is a lot of work. And she still has to kind of want to do it. She has to really want to do it,
yes.
For it to happen.
Yeah.
And so in a scenario on a set where you're partnered with someone that you were booked with, that you didn't pick out yourself, that you're probably not attracted to,
yeah.
You're surrounded by people, you're doing a scenario that may or may not turn you on. Like, because right. You're there doing a job. So maybe you're doing a scene where you're playing a student or a teacher, and that's something that is not a fantasy for you. Or maybe it's a real turnoff for you, but you've got to stay in character because you were hired today to do that fantasy, whether or not that turns you on.
And in between takes, isn't it like just some dude just standing there like jerking off, trying to keep his heart on kind of deal?
I mean, it depends. You know, I mean, some performers try to generate chemistry and they try to keep it going and keep it as authentic as it can be given the circumstances, but the circumstances make it hard.
I can't believe I've never like been to, well, yeah, I can. What am I saying? Like, why haven't I been to a porn set? You know what I mean? Like, how come that's not my life? I mean, I knew, that was not a thing. There's no field trips.
Yeah.
Well,
and we've become increasingly cloistered as the relationship.
Porn community?
Yeah. I mean, the relationship between porn and mainstream has become just increasingly fraught. In terms of, I think it used to be that the adult side of things really courted the validation of mainstream. And so whenever a mainstream project wanted to do a documentary about porn or wanted to come on set because they're making a movie about porn,
right.
Porn people would be really receptive to that because we crave that kind of validation or acknowledgement that we are sort of a legitimate site of labor and that our stories are important.
Right.
You know, and they are.
Yeah.
But I think we've reached a nadir of understanding that unless that all of these projects are inevitably geared towards having a very specific narrative about our labor.
Which is what?
That it's inevitably horrible, exploitative, that no
and
one...
you're all broken.
All broken. No one can come out of it happy.
Right.
Or if someone comes out of it, they have to do so with the complete disavowal of the industry as a whole.
And contrition of some kind.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a different person. I was lost. It was in PTSD. Yep. I was being held hostage.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much goes back to sort of this American cultural attitude that's very puritanical, which you see it in cancel culture too, which is there must be a confession of guilt. Then there must be like an auto de fe, like a sort of, you know,
the walk of shame.
Yeah.
The Scarlet A.
Yeah. I mean, so we're still very much that culture.
Yeah. That's true. But I felt like there was a minute there where porn was like, it seemingly was like integrating, you know, kind of a lot into mainstream culture. Like there was a point with internet porn where it was so common that it was a conversation everywhere, and that like it became so what's the word I want? It's widespread that there was no mystique to it anymore.
Well, I think that was social media.
Yeah.
And so I would point that at around 2009. A lot of people would attribute it to Sasha Gray. I have my theory around it, and it's a theory because I'm not a scholar, but it has to do with the rise of social media and the streaming of porn.
Yeah.
So it's omnipresence and it's ubiquity, coupled with social media getting everyone online, you know, because people forget that before social media, it was mainly forums and websites. And so if you were really into something, you had to go to a forum or a bulletin board.
And you
or
still
a
had to get
board.
The DVDs.
Yeah, but like not even just for porn. I mean, for anything.
Yeah.
It's like there was no social media. People have been with it so long,
right.
They've forgotten that there was a time when in order to find people that shared specific interests and to share content like bootleg recordings from, you know, Fleetwood Mac concerts or whatever your thing was that you were trying to do, you had to go find these message
Zeppelin
boards. There
wasn't Live 73.
Yeah, like there wasn't a hub like Twitter where, you know,
you could just put it out there.
But I think the main thing that happened is there was, and I think this happened across all industries, is that when the tech for creating art, whether it was like Adobe Audition or podcasts or Ableton Live or cell phone, like camera phones, right? That this technology suddenly emerged that could allow any creator to upload their content, create their content on par with what before had been these super professionals.
Yeah.
And then being able to upload it to places like YouTube where there was suddenly a sort of social media hub.
Yeah.
So you had, there was this moment where anyone could kind of make the content and everyone could network with each other and have a social media presence and everyone was sharing this stuff. And so you had, before that, especially in porn, it was very corporate, which is, there were contract girls and then there were gonzo girls. And the contract girls had these very curated images. You know, they were put through media training.
I mean, contract girls with a company?
Yeah.
One of the three or four?
Yeah, like Digital Playground or Wicked or Vivid.
Yeah.
And so those girls might get some kind of media training. They would be very heavily branded.
Yeah. I remember the boxes.
Yeah. And those boxes, I had a director tell me that they would spend like 20, 30 grand on a box cover shoot. Like that's how important they were. And part of that meant that, you know, there wasn't just direct access to the girls. And especially like with music or acting or anything else, right? There was just no direct access.
Period. Yeah. This,
to anybody.
The age of boundaryless kind of insanity is it's the worst.
Which
if somebody wants to get in touch with you, they will and they can. If they're persistent, they'll find you. They'll track you down somehow.
Yeah.
And everyone's so insecure and needy and kind of like egotistical that like they say that if... The weird thing about being, and I'm sure, well, you deal with it because it's actually part of your job, but you don't want to deal with that stuff. But if they catch you on the right day, you're going to respond to an email, even though you shouldn't.
Oh, yeah.
But you just sort of one day you're like, no, I'll go.
Well, like also it's removed the part of you that even thinks about it. I have like across social media, I have maybe 1 million, 2 million followers, right? And I'll go on and be posting pictures of my dog or my breakfast or my latest thoughts on abortion or whatever without really considering how wide of an audience I'm sending that message to.
Yeah. Or who or where they're going to send it.
Yeah. But so the thing is, I think for porn girls, the thing that it really helped in terms of the rights of sex workers and the humanization and destigmatization of porn was that girls suddenly could run their own brands.
Right.
They were building their own brands and they were going on Twitter and Tumblr and these places and they were building up their own following of people.
As the corporate production houses were kind of falling, right?
Yeah. And so it was the first time that consumers were getting to view the performers as human beings.
Yeah,
they were not these carefully curated.
Well, you were being human.
Yeah. Yeah. And that really did a lot to kind of mainstream porn.
Right,
because
right.
all these. And then also during the Tumblr era, and there was the emergence of Sasha Gray, who was a new kind of porn star because she had opinions and ideas and vocalized them. And, you know,
what happened to her?
She's still around. I mean, she retired in, I think, like 2010 or 2011. But she's now a very wholesome Twitch streamer. She does a lot of cooking and gaming on Twitch and still has a really rabid following.
No filth? No more?
No. She seems to have landed on her feet and is doing well for herself.
Well, let's go back. How long have you been in California?
I moved here in 2011, 2012.
Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in Fresno, California, Central Valley.
Yeah, Fresno. And your mom's still there?
No, she's in Riverside.
Who's in Fresno?
My adoptive father.
Your adoptive
father. I have two dads.
Two dads. So, real dad in like...
Well, the real dad is the adoptive dad. And then
really?
I have a biological father who was always... Him and my mom divorced before I was born. And I've always known who he is.
Yeah.
And... He's, I think, total in life, we've maybe spent 3 months together. I mean, it was a place I would go visit for like a week or two every summer to whatever.
Identify
and
your father,
I mean,
biological.
He definitely was the reason I started doing stand-up. He had a passion for stand-up comp. He loved it. So he would watch Lenny Bruce and Bill Hicks and Richard Pryor and all like those albums
were
always playing. He was always doing bits. So I think I immediately kind of got interested in comedy because it was a way that we could connect and it was a way to feel connected to him.
When you were a kid?
Yeah, when I was really little. So I would like memorize the jokes too and I would watch all this stuff.
Is he out in the desert or something?
He lives in Arizona now.
Right.
But for the most part, I grew up, he was in Ashland, Oregon, and then in Seattle.
What is he, like an off-the-grid guy?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he's just old and retired.
I mean, okay, I think of Oregon and Arizona, it's like, it seems like a type of person.
I mean, it is.
Was he like a hippie dude or no?
Well, him and my mom were both heroin addicts. That's how they met. It was a love story.
Oh, wow. Where was this? Where did they have that courtship?
Okay. This is actually one of my favorite stories. It's very romantic.
That's great.
My mom was 17 and dropped acid. She was living in New York. And she dropped acid, and she had this vision that Jesus Christ was in San Quentin Penitentiary under the name, like, Charles something.
Uh-huh.
And so she decided she was going to go talk to God. She had some questions.
She's going to go to
San Quentin and visit Jesus. So she hitchhiked from New York to...
Didn't she come down at some point and realize, like, the fuck am I doing?
You know, my mom is committed, if anything. You know, you got to see it through.
Sure, okay.
So she hitchhiked across the country, and she made it as far as Nevada, and then... She got picked up by a trucker and they ended up going down this dark lane and the trucker tried to make a pass at her and she was not having it. And so he kicked her out at the side of the road in the middle of the night, pitch black, no freeway lights, nothing.
Mm.
And she just kind of stood in the dark for a really long time waiting to see what was going to happen to her next.
Yeah.
And then she describes it as this pair of headlights emerged and like was coming toward her and they hit a sign behind her that lit up, the reflective sign, and it said Hallelujah Junction.
Yeah.
And she was like,
This is it.
We're on our way.
Yeah.
So it was two couples that were on honeymoon that were like on their way to Lake Tahoe, I guess.
Uh-huh.
They picked her up. Felt really bad for her.
Yeah.
And she...
The sad hippie girl?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so they pooled their money together and gave her money to get a bus ticket. And the nearest place she could get to was Reno, Nevada. And so she took the bus, the Greyhound to Reno, Nevada, got off the bus and was told she should go work at one of the casinos, apply for work there. So she walked in. So she had to have been older. Now I'm thinking like she had to have been older than 17.
Yeah.
She would have to have been old enough to work in the casino. She was young, but yeah, she did get a job there. She was there as a blackjack dealer.
Yeah.
So she got a job as a blackjack dealer there.
Yeah.
And then one day my dad came in.
Yeah.
And she was like, so my mom tells me that she would constantly go on these attempts to get clean off of drugs.
But she's not on dope yet?
No, she was. Oh, she was like.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
So she's a blackjack dealer with a habit.
Oh, yeah. Oh. But she's like, she had told me that she would constantly do these things where she would put herself in scenarios in which getting drugs was very difficult an attempt to quit.
And she's so are we in the 80s here or where are we?
This is the 70s.
Okay.
Late 70s.
Yeah.
And so my dad walked in and was asked for a job application. And she was like, and, you know, I just saw him and I just could immediately tell that he knew where to get heroin.
That was love at first sight.
And so she didn't see him for a while around the casino. And she said there was a break room.
Yeah.
And one day she was in the break room taking a nap and she woke up and my dad was in there watching her. Apparently he had gotten a job as a short order cook at the casino.
Uh-huh.
And she said like they started hanging out and doing drugs together. And like 2 weeks later, he asked if he could move in with her. And she said, I can't live with anyone I'm not married to. I'm an old fashioned girl. And so he went to Woolworths and brought like two brass rings and they went and got married at the courthouse and they stayed married for like 7 or 8 years.
Really?
Yeah. They ended up moving up together to Oregon.
Is that and your brother's older?
Yeah.
So they had him first?
They had him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then by the time they had me, they were already kind of done with each other. And
were they sober?
She got sober for me. Uh-huh. She had tried to get sober several times. At the time that they divorced, my dad had been put in like a recovery, kind of a halfway house type situation because he was like strong arming and doing like robberies and stuff. And this is all, it's getting mixed up, but there was something around like he was like doing a robbery or a burglary and like dropped a pill bottle that had his name and address on it.
the one pill bottle he had that was actually a legit prescription.
Yeah, and then got busted for it. And then it was like he had tried to escape jail one time and like by trying to jump out the window. And then he was like in the hospital in a coma. And the only way that she found out was because these nuns, it was a Catholic hospital that he ended up at. And these nuns that used to go to, like, they were at this faith healer's compound in the mountains in Oregon.
What? Who your folks were?
Yeah. And these nuns would come out there all the time trying to like proselytize or whatever.
Why were they at a faith healer's compound?
Cheap rent. That's what she said.
Oh. They weren't part of
it. Cheapest rent in the house. Yeah. Oh. So
they were kind of in a cult?
Yeah, kind of. Uh-huh. I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's no clarity.
Yeah.
How is this not the story you're telling? Where's this book? Where's this fucking movie?
I mean, it's her story. But anyway, so she didn't know. My dad had kind of gone missing, and she didn't know, like, what, or, no, she knew he was in jail,
right.
But these nuns that, like, would go to this compound and kind of try to get people out, recognized, they were at the hospital, and, like, recognized that this was her husband, and that they had a young child, and so the nuns basically went and told her, like,
He's
in a coma. And she's like, you know, your dad was such a good con man. She's like, that I walked into that hospital room and she's like, you know, he looked like wax, like waxy, like he looked out. And she's like, and I walked up to him and I was just like, Johnny, like, are you faking it? Like, if you're faking it, just like blink twice. Like she was convinced that like it wasn't real. Like she was like, she's like, he was that charming and he was that good.
Wow.
Yeah.
What would have been the end of, what was that? What was the goal of that grift though? Just to lay down for a while, get the drugs, be on an IV?
But he, like, my dad has always been this very charming kind of womanizer type guy. There was, he he ended up getting into like what they call now, I guess what they would call it is a diversion program, where was able to negotiate down time in exchange for going into rehab.
Yeah.
But that rehab was like a lockdown kind of place. Uh-huh. And it was run by this woman. And the way my mom tells the story, and I feel like nowadays I have to caveat everything with like, here's what I was told.
Right. Sure. Of course.
The way my mom tells the story is that the woman that directed this program decided that the only way that they could get that my dad could get sober is if he divorced my mom. And so was trying to make it like this condition of him getting into the diversion program that he had to agree to divorce.
Why would they
my
do that?
Mom. And my mom said that it was like the public defender was the one that actually like went to bat and was like, you can't make that a condition of somebody's whatever. And my mom was convinced it was because like my dad was fucking the lady.
Oh, right.
Like sure. she's like, it's just
not
like,
because they were trying to separate two drug addicts.
Yeah, no, it's just like it's well, her thing was just like it's the kind of thing he would do and get away with. Like
so
he would be the kind of guy that would convince a like a lady in that position
to get him out of the marriage.
Yeah,
in a like, way that would not cop to him being fucking her,
or like or that he could talk that lady into fucking him.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like that she would be like, I could lose my job and everything else, but why not?
Yeah, sure. This guy's charming.
And
so
I mean, I kind of believe her to be honest.
Yeah, that he
like,
was
he's that charming.
Sure, I like, mean it's possible. So this guy, and then after that, he kind of went his own way, and your mom married somebody else, and that,
my mom never remarried. My dad ended up marrying the girl, the woman that he was cheating on my mom with when I was born.
Wow, it's a complicated story.
Yeah, my dad's been married 5 times, twice to the same woman, and all but 2 of his wives have passed away.
So,
like one woman twice.
But you don't consider him an active part of your childhood other than visits?
Not really.
So it was just you and your mom?
Yeah.
And then when I was
3 or 4. My adoptive father came in, and he has been consistently
but he's not like, married to your mom.
No.
They're just together.
They were together for a long time. They broke up when I was 12, but it's kind of cute.
Decent guy?
Amazing person.
Oh, that's
amazing
good.
Amazing person. To this day, she's still, we're still up in Fresno. And she still goes and stays with him periodically just to make sure he's healthy. He's in his early 80s now.
Wow.
So, yeah. Like, they haven't been together for a very, very long time, but they still, you know, are there for each other and kind of
and
still.
What were you doing, you know, like, in high school and stuff? I mean, because I know, like, I only know parts of your story from, you know, talking to you, and I know about, you know, the graduate program and all this stuff, and I know about the drugs, but I don't know how it all fits together. So your adoptive stepfather leaves it at you're 12, and it's you and your mom. And your
well, he
mom,
doesn't leave. My mom moved out, and he still would pick me up every day and drive me to school and have
your
breakfast
mom was
with
clean?
Me. And, oh, yeah.
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 Like AA clean?
NA.
NA? Oh,
yeah. I've never seen my parents loaded.
Really?
Which is actually kind of worse in some ways because they're clean.
Yeah.
But they're completely emotionally immature and unavailable. So,
well, that's, yeah. Well, oh,
you
sorry.
Know. Huh. And so it's that thing where they may be clean, but, you know, your recovery is not necessarily something that is commensurate with time sober.
Right.
You know?
You might never get better emotionally.
You could spend decades still being a fucking addict and behaving in an addict way. And,
well, theoretically,
you know,
if you work these steps, it's supposed to give you a handle on that.
Well, I'd say that my mom and dad, I mean, my dad is a
real dad or adopted?
My biological father went into psychology and was in rehab stuff, like helping people recover.
So he's
a big time NA person.
Drug counselor.
And then my mom's a neonatal intensive care unit nurse and has been since I can remember, specifically because she wanted to help drug addicted babies because my brother was born addicted to drugs. And when I was born, or she told me the story that when my brother was born and she was holding him in the hospital, she had told herself that if she could ever manage to get clean, she wanted to be like these nurses that were helping her and showing her all of this compassion, even though she was a fucking addict.
Yeah.
So they both, I would say, are amazing human beings. I mean, the recovery
service.
Rate.
They locked into service.
The recovery rate from heroin addiction is like 2%.
It's terrible.
They're superheroes already for just
sure.
getting and staying clean off of heroin. And they have been of incredible service to other people. And I know they sponsor lots of people and they speak around the world and they have a lot of fucking clean time.
Yeah.
All of this stuff. But it's that same thing of like, you know, the hardest thing to do is like yourself and those inner family
sure,
dynamics.
Yeah, because
I think
you're locked
you know,
into a pattern that becomes, it's easier to deal with people. Than,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
So when do you start using drugs?
I started using drugs when I was 14.
What was your, like when you were in high school, outside of doing comedy bits with your father, and like, did you have things you wanted to do?
Well, I had been a writer since I was about four.
Yeah.
And it was just because I always had, it's funny to me now that I did porn or that I do stand up or anything like that, because I was painfully, painfully shy for a very long time. I mean, like full-blown panic attacks, like sweating, like
in what situations when you had
any situation.
Yeah.
My home life was really turbulent and the way that I responded to the trauma was to become like a very avoidant fawn.
How was it turbulent?
A lot of just emotional instability. You know, emotionally. And like my adoptive father was a very stabilizing influence. He's never done drugs in his life.
Yeah.
He's never been high. He's never smoked a cigarette.
Right.
He's, you know, just like was a coach and a teacher and a Midwest guy, like taught me how to fix cars, taught me, you know, like just such an antidote to my mother.
So where was the insanity? Your mother?
But my mom was fucking nuts.
Uh-huh. Drama?
Just like vibrating with her own anxiety and distress and unresolved trauma. And then I think for her having, because she had endured a lot of sexual abuse and things like that when she was young. And I think for her, like having a daughter, like really kind of triggered in her a lot of anxiety that made her, you know, one, she was constantly, I think, being triggered.
Yeah, right.
About her own shit.
Yeah.
And then she
because of your existence.
Yeah. Just like all I had to do was be there, you know, and then I was a pretty little girl. Mm. And I remember one of the, like my most vivid memories from childhood is my physical appearance being treated like a crisis. Like the number of talks that I would have, like the number of times.
About
that,
what? You're pretty. You got to be careful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, which was really traumatizing.
Yeah.
Because it made me feel like I was wrong no matter what.
Right.
It made me feel like my very existence was wrong. And I remember my mom's father, who was a Frenchman that would come visit like every couple years. And
the Frenchman?
Yeah. Like what? Because that was the thing. He felt like it was this foreign guy that she was really obsessed with.
This is your grandfather.
Yeah. That like didn't make sense to me.
From France?
Yeah.
Or Canada?
From France. And I remember him just sitting me down one day and saying, listen, you're a very beautiful girl, but one day someone's going to want to talk to you and you better have something to say. And I remember that, like...
that's his advice? The first
His whole thing was don't rely on it. Don't, you know, that it's the one thing that's going to go away. Everyone's going to love you for that. And then it's going to go away and no one will love you anymore.
So that was an inspiration in a way.
It was. But like, it was the same thing with even my adoptive father, when he would be taking me around to hardware stores and shit like that when I was a little girl. And when guys would be like, oh, she's so pretty.
Yeah.
And he would say, don't say that. I don't want her to think it's important.
Yeah. Give her a wrench.
Yeah. He was really like, he was like, but I remember him overhearing him say that one day where he's like, I don't want her to think it's important. Like, don't say that to her. I don't like it.
It seems like these men were trying to help in their weird way.
Yeah. But I mean, the overall thing was this ambient stressor of like, you're in danger. And also, you're not good enough. And also, the only reason people like you is because of the way you look.
Yeah.
But that's bad.
Right.
So it was just this weird kind of hornet's nest of shit.
And you were writing.
That triggered this just intense anxiety. I just didn't want to interact with people because it felt like every interaction was wrong.
Yeah.
And
so
unsafe.
How long did that last?
It lasted a really long time. So I was always a writer, and my form of escapism was I would write little stories and do little things where I would and when my mom gave me a box of all of the, she had saved all of it.
Yeah.
And so there's my first poem I wrote when I was four.
Yeah.
Yes.
How was it?
It's cute. Okay. But and when I read through the stuff, the theme that I see is just this one of escapism where I'm trying to imagine myself into places where it's always like going to some kingdom where there's like a benevolent queen and king that are reliable.
Yeah.
And that it's a place where there's not like this suffering and like they're not really these extravagant fantasies.
Right.
Like what I see is someone that's just longing for some kind of sense of stability and security.
And also like maybe magic.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And so I was always writing and I would try and excel academically because also I really started to cling to teachers as the stabilizing influence because everything at home just felt really chaotic. And as awesome as my adoptive dad was, he's also very taciturn. So we never talked about feelings or emotions.
Yeah.
So he was always there. I always knew that financially and if I needed stuff that Dad was there, but he was not someone that I would ever talk to about feelings, and he never talked about feelings, like, ever.
Well, it's interesting, that search for, like, parents, when your parents are however they're detached or emotionally negligent or abusive, the constant sort of gaping need thing that you walk around the world with is the worst. I mean, I did it too. It's always sort of like, well, will you be my dad? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it was big time and it felt kind of weird because I did have present parents.
Yeah.
But I felt like I didn't.
Well, the emotional support was they were too wrapped up in their own shit.
Yeah.
So then you just sort of get abandoned to kind of, you know, manufacture some inner parent that's never good and then like walk around looking at adults to do it.
Yeah. And so I really leaned into school. You know, and I was always teacher's pet because like there was one thing I figured out really quickly, which is that I was really smart.
Yeah.
And I was really good at pleasing people.
Uh-huh.
I was really good at just tamping down whatever my emotional state was to smooth things over.
Well, you're like, you know, how could you not with that mother? How could you not be just sort of a born codependent?
Yeah. So that the real reason that I excelled academically wasn't even about like I'm a genius and I'm smarter than other people. It was just like, that was where I knew what I had to input to get the output.
Yeah.
I input the work.
Yeah.
The output is praise and acceptance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, that was very comforting to me because I didn't have to guess. Do the assignment, get an A, get love.
Mm.
Easy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I walked through most of my life, even now as an adult, longing for that kind of clarity around how to do it and how to get it.
Yeah. So when you graduated high school, you were like a star student kind of deal?
Well, I graduated early. So I started doing drugs in high school. I was still performing academically really well.
What drugs?
I went straight from nothing to crank and methamphetamine.
Crank.
And
old school.
Yeah.
Crank.
Truck stop speed.
Yeah.
So I went.
That was Fresno.
And the reason that that happened was because I could do it and allowed me to perform academically.
Yeah.
Like a peer.
Yeah.
For me, drug use was always about being Wonder Woman. It was never about getting high.
Yeah.
It was always about being able to perform, like to outperform anybody else because I felt like that's all I had. That was that was my USP.
Were you snorting it, shooting it?
Snorting it.
Yeah.
I was not shooting it at 15. I wasn't that cool. I wasn't that awesome.
Yeah.
But so I ended up getting sent to rehab, two different rehabs.
At 15?
Yeah. And so that disrupted my schooling. And when I came back, and while I was in rehab, I got outed as being queer. Even though I went to a performing arts high school where like everyone was gay, but I was a girl and gay. So it was different.
Yeah.
It was like there was an acceptance that the males in the ballet department were queer. And it was accepted that the guys in the art department might be queer and that some of the theater guys were queer.
Yeah.
But for like when I was outed as being queer, I had a girlfriend.
Yeah.
It hit different. And so I was like, get me out of here. So I took
What happened?
I took summer school every...
But like, how did you get outed? What was the...
I don't know.
Started making fun of you or...
It just became...
A joke?
Well, it became tense. I went to performing arts high school, but it was attached to a traditional high school in a super like Mexican Catholic traditional area. Like the population of that high school had these very conservative values around shit like that. And that was scary to people. And so it wasn't just people making fun of me. I mean, it was like a genuine hostility that was kind of...
So what'd you
fraught.
Do?
It was, and so I just went in and was like, I want to get out early. So I took some AP courses, some honors courses. I went to summer school for two semesters and I graduated early.
And you were sober?
Yeah.
So after you graduate the high school and your mom, you know, encourages you to do the creative thing? Is that what drove you? I mean, did you move into that then?
Yeah. Well, so then I got into the program, and I'd been writing poems and stuff like that, because I'd in high school I'd gotten enmeshed in this really how I'd met the girlfriend was there was this kind of arts cafe district in town where all of these people of various ages that were playwrights and poets and independent musicians, all these people, would all congregate.
Yeah.
And I started congregating there.
Hanging out
and getting kind of taken under wing by a lot of these people. So that's when I first got the idea that I wanted to be, like, I always knew I wanted to be a performer. I went to a performing arts high school.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, like, I was
you didn't
in,
know what kind of performing?
Well, I was in theater and ballet and playwriting, but because I was so painfully shy, I couldn't perform. So I'd leaned on dance because it didn't require talking, and then, of course, writing because it didn't require being on stage.
Right.
And puberty really kind of just doubled up. Like, it was like a shot in the arm to any kind of anxiety that was already there. It just made it crippling. Which is really why I'd leaned into writing in college. But so I knew those people in that time in high school had been where I first got the idea that I knew I wanted to be involved in entertainment or the arts, or that I was going to be like an artist.
It's good to meet. It's like, you know, it's good to have those people. Like, I used to hang around the university when I was in high school, and it was just like, just to be around it and to know that, like, you know, people do this.
Yeah.
It's good. Know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I still didn't, it was still a small town, and I didn't see a direct path to say what I'm doing now, which is probably why we didn't have like a stand-up comedy scene there.
Yeah. So, well, no one knows how to do that.
Well, I mean, yeah, pretty much.
I mean, when I started, there was like, you know, you just got to figure out where and how to do it. I mean, like, when you started, at least it was, there was a lot of places.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the same with like what you're doing now, which is, you know, trying to sell a TV show, you know, that's something you just have to learn on the fucking job, you know?
Yeah.
But so when did you go, where did you go after high school? When did you start college? When was that?
So I was 16 when I started college.
Really?
Yeah.
Where was that? At Davis?
No.
That was the graduate thing?
No. I was always at, I don't want to say, I was at Fresno State. It's just like, there's so many things that I was thinking about this a lot before I came here, because there's so many things and there's so many stories around what got me here that involve people that have moved on with their lives. And like, just the thing I've become really aware of in the last year or two especially is like that, like, wanting people shouldn't have to necessarily suffer consequences later on down the line for shit they did when they were kids. And so I kept going like, what am I going to be able to talk about? Because there are so many kind of defining moments that like that involve sort of like, they kind of open up a hell mouth into
what? I mean, without you know, naming names, what are you considering a defining moment?
And being sexually assaulted by my mentor professor in graduate school, which completely destroyed my life. But that is like, I don't want to be defined by that, but like that defined like everything that came after it.
Yeah.
And so that is always my hesitation with doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Is it's like, I don't want that person to have air.
Yeah.
And I also don't want anyone to question me.
Right.
And that's inevitably what happens.
Yeah.
And it becomes so easy to take these moments and go like, well, because that happened, then that's why she made this choice over here. And I feel like that experience is like incredibly common, and those people don't end up doing porn, but they do end up being as broken as I was for many, many years.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think, and that's always my fear with everything or with having these conversations, is there's an internal pressure around like not wanting to disappoint the people that are still there.
Yeah.
That like my experience is not everyone's experience. And there are a lot of broken people that don't do this job. And there are a lot of really healthy people that do this job. And for
the
them,
porn
it's,
job.
Yeah. And for them, it's okay. For them, it's really liberating.
Like when you say healthy people doing it as a job or as now that they have the ability to do OnlyFans or whatever, because there's like, I've seen some of that stuff. I don't know about that whole world, but it seems like people who just have it, an idea to do it. They could be, you know, housewives or whatever. They can do it now.
Yeah.
And it's and it can be empowering and it can be exciting. It can be extra income.
I mean,
it doesn't have to be some indicator that this is a fucked up person.
I just feel like there's a desire to reinforce this sort of misogyny and patriarchal kind of structure of society by having these narratives around anything that economically empowers women or that acknowledges that women's sexual labor is valuable.
Yeah.
Like, all of patriarchy is kind of predicated on the idea that women are worthless. So, like anytime we do anything that reinforces the idea that what women do with sex is labor, it's a treat for you.
Right.
But it's usually labor on her end.
And it's labeled as immoral.
So there's a really quick desire, this knee-jerk desire to kind of reinforce any kind of narrative that's like,
slut.
Yeah, this is horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she may be economically empowered, but she's miserable, you know?
Or
like,
she's broken and she's, you know, garbage.
Yeah.
But, all right, so, but leading up to that, so you did your undergraduate.
So I did my undergrad, and I, at that time, was it
for writing? You got into the writing.
Yeah, I was doing English lit, and I had been a poet and all this stuff, but, you know, I suffered from anxiety and all of that. And I actually was double majoring in sociology because I still was like, but I'm going to, like, do the other thing, right? So it's like,
that was the backup plan?
Yeah. I was like, this is cute, but like, let me at least be a
therapist or something?
Yeah. I was like, well, at least let me get, like, a sociology degree as well. That way, you know, I'll, like, the English lit, that'll make me really good at writing grants.
Right. And then I'll have an ology.
The sociology part, like, I knew that as a degree was kind of one of the most flexible in terms of going into, say, social work or doing and any kind of, like, public sector stuff.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like it was still kind of like it would give me that flexibility.
Yeah.
And then because when I got assaulted by the professor, I mean, that just kind of.
And how many years? So you went to graduate school to write?
Yeah.
And
so basically the same institution.
Okay.
So I was doing English lit and sociology and I was actually way more excited about doing the sociology stuff because I still didn't see a practical way to be a writer.
Right.
It just didn't seem practical to me. I had done some workshops and a professor pulled me aside and was like, "You're a really talented poet. Like, you're really good at this."
Yeah.
"And I think you should do the graduate program here and we can get you grants and scholarships. We can pay for it."
Mm.
And that poetry program, the last two poet laureates of the United States came out of that program.
Wow.
Phil Levine and Juan Felipe Pereira. So,
no kidding.
I mean, it was like there was some bona fides to that program.
Sure.
And I had never, up until that point, like I'd always performed well academically and all of that stuff, but I just had never had someone.
The confidence in the creativity.
Someone say, like, "You're so good at this, we want to give it money."
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'd not had that.
Right.
And I was writing about a lot of the stuff I was going through emotionally. I moved out of my mom's house the day I turned 18. But I was still feeling a lot of turmoil. And, when I look back on it now, a lot of the turmoil was around how to disconnect from that relationship with my mom.
Yeah.
And I was also, you know, kind of wrestling with men paying attention to me. I was still a virgin at that point and, like, was trying to navigate being a grown-up in terms of academically and intellectually, but being completely socially immature.
Yeah.
Because I had never tried to have social skills and I had this crippling anxiety and it made me very vulnerable. And so I just didn't, because of all that upbringing I had that was like, you're always in danger in the presence of a man, you cannot trust men and all that kind of stuff, which kind of made what happened when I was assaulted by the professor at my senior year in college was what made it so devastating.
Like, you knew
it was the one. It was the first person that I had ever trusted.
Yeah.
Outside of my family.
Yeah.
And it was heartbreaking. And then that person, like, basically stalked me for like a year afterwards, like while this was going through. Like while the police reports were being filed and because I called the cops. And the thing is, like, it's very different today than it was then. When I called the police, the first question I was asked if I was dating him.
Yeah.
And then as it got referred to the DA's, like, sexual assault team, And they called me and said that they thought that they shouldn't press charges because I was going to have to testify against them, and that was going to be really hard for me. And they just didn't think that there was going to be enough evidence, even though there was, I mean, like, by today's standards, what they were saying was, like, fucking ridiculous. Mm. But then I got off the phone with them, and someone else called from their office confidentially and said, I looked into it for you, and if you go through the school's like sexual harassment policy through civil court, you actually have XYZ, and I've looked up all the things and all of the title violations that have gone on here, mm-hmm. and like this is something that you could do, and that would probably get this person removed from their tenure and everything mm-hmm. else. And so I went through that route, which sucked because it never feels good to not go through the criminal justice route.
Right.
Because as soon as you do that, it immediately makes it like, oh, harassment, which I felt what happened was not harassment. It was assault, and it was horrible. And like, it devastated me. And it sent me on a path for years afterwards.
And what happened ultimately? Did you get it? Did you resolve? Did you get resolution?
He ended up, you know, stalking people, and there was an investigation, and it went through this and that.
Still teaching, though.
Yep. And then when it came down to the fact that he was going to have to go to court, he resigned. Mm. And I was told to be happy with that result, and then found out that a semester later he was hired at another university in the system. Wow. As if nothing had happened.
So like the priests.
Yeah. I mean, essentially that's what happened. Mm. And like, but that the whole, I'll never regret that I stood up for myself, and that I went through with it, and that I testified, and that I put myself through one of the most humiliating processes you can go through, which is being questioned and being opened up, being interrogated around like everything about your life. And I mean, one of the ironies was that the thing that in the end they were sold on, they were like, well, normally when people are making this up, they're doing it for attention, but she's a straight A student and she's considered kind of like a star academic, and she's really well liked by all of her peers, so that doesn't make sense. And she's queer, so that also doesn't make sense. She's a lesbian. Because at that point, like, I'd never, you know what I mean? I'd never even, like, had a boyfriend. I'd never done it. You know what I mean? Like, I had, and so, which was, like, this weird irony, because I was like, that shouldn't be the reason that he's guilty. Like, those things should both be irrelevant. What should be relevant is that there were, like, witnesses to just before and immediately after that were convinced that something really horrible had happened on the in-between, and they all came forward and they all testified on my behalf, and they all said they believed me, and they all said he had even partially confessed to someone else that he thought was going to be sympathetic to him. Mm. And that person came forward, and they were very disturbed by what he had told them. So it's like, I'll never regret having done it.
Yeah.
It felt really empowering to do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, it was just devastating to, it just stripped mine to my self-esteem.
Yeah, and so what were the immediate repercussions of that? Did you leave the school?
I had just gotten accepted to the graduate school at the same place. Yeah. And so I was constantly afraid and worried that people thought that I got into the program as like a peace offering, even though I'd already been admitted and accepted and all that stuff way before any of this had happened. But also, like, I was in distress, you know, while I was preparing testimony and being stalked, like, with no help. No, like, I would complain endlessly. No help. Mm. You know, this guy would show up at my door, like, banging on my apartment, stuff like
to
that.
To try to get you to shut up?
Yep. Yeah. And it was like, I had no help, no recourse. So I'm doing all of that while trying to go to school, which was horrible. And like trying to focus on grad school, like while that's happening. Yeah, I mean, it was just like, it was just, and not feel like I could talk to anybody about it, because I felt like I had to be tough. Mm. And
there was no counseling available, or you couldn't trust anybody.
I mean, it's like, I felt so, I was already so anxious and suspicious of people.
Sure.
And the first time I'd been looked at someone as a mentor, that is how I was repaid. And like one of the other things is it launched me into my first relationship with a man that ended up being an incredibly abusive situation. And it was because I felt so unsafe.
How'd you meet that guy?
I was working at a pool hall.
Wait, so you leave school?
No, I'm going to school and I'm working. Yeah. I'm like going to school. I'm working as an ESL tutor.
Yeah.
I wasn't accepted.
What's ESL?
English is a second language.
Okay.
At the college, and then taking a full load as a graduate student.
Yes.
And working a job.
Yeah.
So I'm doing all of that while also going through like this harrowing fucking process.
Yeah.
Of whatever.
Yeah.
And so I met this guy and it was like he was really into me. He kind of took control.
Where'd you meet him?
At the pool hall. And I got invited to this party at his house after hours. And he was like, all the other waitresses there thought this guy was really cool. He was very attractive, very charismatic, very. And he just liked me right away.
I mean,
we were in our 20s. Like, right, I was barely 21. He was a little older.
Yeah.
But, like, he was, like, already a manager at a retail store and all. Like, he was already, like, a boss, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, sure.
in this way that seemed very impressive.
Yeah.
And he just knew what he wanted and was really into me. And like when we met, it's like there was this couple fighting in the parking lot. And I was in his car to go to his house. And he started following the couple. And he's like, I'm worried about that girl. And then he like stopped his car and like got out and walked over to the couple and was like, is everything okay here? And I remember feeling like really like impressed by that.
Safe.
And that was going to be me in another year.
Sure.
I was going to be the girl in the parking lot with him being the fucking horrible guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like physically?
It was bad.
Too?
I don't want to get
physical?
Into all of it, but right. it was bad. It was toxic. It was like me leaving in the middle of the night, not telling anyone where I was going and feeling like
go?
I couldn't. I went and found another apartment. And I found a landlord that would.
Oh, you had moved in with him?
Oh, yeah. Like we were in it. We were going to get married.
How long was that for?
That was a 2-year relationship.
And it ended in horror.
Yeah.
Chaos.
It was bad. It was really bad. But like
abuse.
What got me into that relationship was feeling like when I had made my own decisions, because I had just gotten free from my mom and gotten into my own place. And then immediately this fucking guy, this professor had done what he had done. And I felt scared and really vulnerable. And this guy came in and it just seemed like he was really controlling and all that stuff. But just some part of me felt like he knows what he wants. He knows the answers. He always has the answers. And all I want is the answers.
Stability. You want that stability.
And so I just leaned into I just leaned into it because I was like, I don't feel safe on my own.
Does your mom know about all this stuff that's going on?
She didn't know. I didn't tell anybody, and that's not uncommon, I guess. Like
about,
I found out later that
but
like
she knew about the professor, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but but not the new guy.
Yeah.
So you leave in the middle of the night, you find another apartment. Then what happens?
So that was when I started doing drugs again. That was like because I was just kind of I couldn't hold it together anymore.
The crank, more crank.
It was meth at that point.
Meth.
Yeah, it was
the
like
next,
it
the
was
next, the evolution.
I mean,
crank.
I was yeah. I had just left an incredibly abusive.
Were you smoking it?
Yep, I was freebasing it. There, I had left an incredibly abusive relationship for. I'd been with this person for 2 years that had really ground me down to nothing. After having been through the whole sexual assault thing.
Oh, so then you're going to do meth to finish the job?
Well, and I'm still going to graduate school. I'm still doing the maximum amount of units allowed. I'm still at this point. I'm now working as a TA, so I'm teaching English 1, working as an English as a second language tutor, and working a full time job as a waitress and bartender so that I can survive. I'm doing all of that on top of being just emotionally devastated. Like
and on meth?
I didn't. The meth was like it literally allowed me to not die from exhaustion.
Yeah. Oh right.
It was just keeping me alive. It was just like animating. It was
sure.
Like,
where did that end go? Where did like how long does that go on for? Meth is pretty devastating, pretty quickly.
You know, I still have all my teeth and I'm still cute.
No,
so
I get it, but still, but mentally, you know.
I ended up moving back into my adoptive father's house.
Yeah.
And kind of fell apart. And I think it was probably the first time in my life that I'd ever let everything just like fall apart.
Yeah.
Because I'd always been like a mascot.
Right.
4.0 grade point average, always on top of everything. And it was like the first time that I allowed myself to just fail.
It couldn't hold anymore.
And I wanted to fail. I think I just was like, you know what? I'm tired. I'm fucking tired.
Yeah.
And I did. And I was like, I'm just going to ride this and see what happens. And that's, I think the other thing about being a writer, a creative person, is it's like you can kind of tell what you're about because there's certain stuff that you'll never stop doing. Like if in the depths of addiction, you're still doing stand up. It's like somehow you find a way.
Sure.
It's like.
And you also, you kind of, right. You know what's, you know, what you deeply want to continue doing because you can't stop it other than the drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
I mean, well, it's definitely one thing, which it refined all of my problems down to one. Where do I cop shit? Every day. Like all of life's, all of the stuff around like, what is the meaning of life? What is my purpose? What am I going to do when I grow up? All of that's gone. And all that's there.
Well, how long did that last?
A long time. Probably. Actually, I feel like it lasted. I did that for about 2 years. It felt like, I don't know, like in tarot, there's like the tower card.
Yeah.
It just felt like this period in my life that was like a tower moment. It was just like literally anything that could fuck up or any way that I could be disillusioned or disappointed or defeated.
Well, where do you get saved by whatever? Where's the knight? Or the princess or whoever. how do you get the fuck out of Fresno?
So it kind of culminated in this trip I took to Hawaii with my brother and my mom, because I had had this moment where I was like, if I keep doing this, I'm a lifer. I'd had one of those moments where I was like, if I stop right now, is a story.
I know that one.
If I keep going right now,
you won't know the difference.
Like, I'm a lifer and I don't want to be a lifer. Yeah. So some part of me in the middle of all of that despair, like had some will to live or transcend all of it. And I ended up taking this trip with my mom and my older brother to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And it's like every 4 or 5 years, my mom would find money to take like a family trip in this attempt to kind of pull us all together. And so we ended up in Kauai.
I love Kauai.
Yeah. On this island at this resort.
Yeah.
And it's like looking back now, I should have been able to just be like, mom, like I'm a drug addict and I'm scared. But like I couldn't. But my older brother, like we were out, we'd gone out early one morning and we were in the ocean together, just me and him.
Yeah.
And I remember just turning to him in the water and crying and saying like, I'm stuck, like something really bad is happening. And he was like, what's going on? And I was like, I'm a drug addict. Like I'm in trouble. Mm. And he was like, okay, like, here's what we're going to do, you know? And he's like, you're going to move in with me in Seattle and like, we're going to take care of it. And it was kind of like this weird, like, it's like we had this secret, right? And it's like, I think it's like that weird kind of bond that you get with a sibling sometimes where it's like, I think he just knew I was in real trouble. Like, because I was always the person in the family that's like, you know, like Jasmine's okay.
Yeah.
Jasmine's fine.
Yeah.
Like that was my job in the family unit, was to like bring up the rear and make everybody look good, you know? So I was always a straight A student. I was really beautiful. Mom and different people had eating disorders. I was like, had a, you know what I mean? It's like, no matter what it was, it's like, I was athletic.
You were
beautiful.
The one who was everyone thought you had your shit together.
Yes.
Right. I get it.
And
I've been that guy.
Yeah. And so I had that. And so I moved to Seattle with my brother.
Mm, thank God.
And was there for 6 months. And it was long enough to get clean.
Yeah.
And it was like the secret, you know, it was like, no one's going to know, you know, it's our little secret.
Yeah.
And he supported me and you know what I mean? Like I didn't pay rent or it's like, he was just like,
that's good.
You just got to come up and like, we'll just handle it. Like we'll just handle it.
Yeah.
And so then I went back to Fresno because I missed my friends, and I kind of like, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to go back and kind of see what I can reconstruct of what I kind of let burn to the ground. And I immediately relapsed. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I immediately, sure. I immediately relapsed.
How are you going to stay sober if you can, you don't have any sort of support system? Or
Yeah. But somewhere in that, I relapsed, but not for as long. It's like I relapsed, and I had a friend that I would use with, this girl, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And I remember one day, we were just high as fuck, and I looked over, and she was, like, playing with her nails, and I realized that she had taken a paper clip and pulled off her thumbnail. And it was, like, this moment where I was, like, and I was, like, I don't want to say her name, but I was, like, Darby. And she's, like, huh? Like, and I was, like, baby, like, what are you? You're bleeding. And she's, like, looking, and I, it was this moment where I was, like, that, like, as weird as it is, that was, like, my weird walk by, where I was, like, I was, like, oh, man. Like,
that's the bad part of
this is fucking, can't do this. And so I kind of sat in my shit for a while, and I got clean on, cold turkey, just, like, stopped everything. And I'd been working off and on this novel, because when I'd gotten really high and was, like, being methed out, I started reading Michel Foucault. And he had this book, Discipline and Punish, and I found it very soothing. I'd never read philosophy before. Like, I'd never...
I have a hard time with it.
I used to, too. But for some reason, when I was in the depths of addiction, that book really changed my life.
That's good.
Like, there was something about the way he was looking at the world in this, like, structured and ordered way that... that calmed me the fuck down. And it helped me to see that there was a way.
It was rational.
And like, I had just grown up in fucking chaos. You know, where every action was a reaction to fear or trauma or distress. Anger or despair. So.
That's like a billiard ball world where you just.
But like, it's just like, I'd never seen someone kind of map it out. Like they're that. That like, it's not just you. That you're part of a structure that has contributed. And like, so it wasn't that it was helping me with addiction, but I was having a quarter life crisis is what I was having.
How old were you?
At this time, I was like 25, 26. So I was having a quarter life crisis, but I didn't have a word for it. You know what I mean? Like that's, but that's what was happening. As I was doing drugs and all of this shit, because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. Or the thing is, I knew what I wanted to do, but I could not overcome my fear of doing it. So I knew I wanted to leave home. I knew I wanted to be an artist. I knew I wanted to be a performer. I knew I wanted to do all that, but that meant moving away from home. It meant going into like all kinds of uncertainty. And as someone that had been raised to be predictable, stable, always right, never fuck up, perfect and correct at all times, that was like an existential crisis.
But you were all, you were pushing your mental limits on speed.
But I didn't know it. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't realize that. And so.
So what did you end up?
So I, there was, we were, I was on MySpace and Tumblr, and there was this site, God's Girls, that was sort of a competitor to Suicide Girls. And it was like $200 per photo shoot, and we'll fly you out for $2,000. Like, send in your photos. And I, it was this thing where it was like, I just, it wasn't like I needed the money per se. It was like, because of everything I talked about in the way I was raised around appearance and like, don't be pretty and don't do this and all of that kind of stuff. It was like, I just, it just seemed like a risk I wanted to take. And I was like, let me do this. And if they accept me, I'll take that as like a sign. And then I can take that money and maybe I can backpack around Europe, because I'd been writing this novel about the Catholic genocide in the Vendée, which is like a footnote of a footnote in Discipline and Punish. That's where the Michel Foucault connection comes in. And so I
And you finished that book. You finished writing it.
I mean,
the novel.
There's so many drafts of it. It's my Leaves of Grass. I'm still working on it. But there is, there is, a, there is, there are many drafts of it. And there's none I would show anybody. But so I submitted and got accepted, and there was a photographer that for the that site that saw my pictures and fell in love with me and started a correspondence with me. And it felt like it took a really long time, but when I look back at the emails, we were emailing for maybe a month or two, and then he he said he wanted to fly me out to New York City where he lived.
Right.
And like we would do all these photographs together. Like he would photograph me for the site. Like,
yeah.
He's like, because typically the site, you would be sent to a photographer that was in like the nearest city, and they had people in LA and New York.
And what were the pictures?
Like it was an alt porn site. It was like softcore, like nudes. It wasn't
just you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he paid for my plane ticket out there. My dad gave me $200, and I went to New York with like a suitcase and $200. Yeah. And I stayed for 3 years. I never went home.
And you stayed with that guy.
Yep.
And like, you did photographs.
We did photographs, and then like fell in love and
right.
kind of became really enmeshed with each other and got kind of swept up in this moment, in this sort of like kind of renaissance of porn movement that happened. It kind of coincided with the Sasha Grey Tumblr. So yeah. It kind of brings us back into like that.
Yeah.
Put us up to like 2012.
Yeah, you're making the...
We're doing all this art stuff, and there's this vision that we're going to be part of this sort of bohemian artistic porn slash whatever. Like, it's hard to explain to people what it felt like in 2009 to 2012, what it felt like to be in porn, where the means of production had been made accessible to everyone. There were these streaming platforms where you could go everyone, and it felt like it kind of... We felt like we were doing radical activism just by living our lives.
And
it's
also
like,
self-ownership.
Yeah.
And just, was he the guy that you sort of credit for getting you over the anxiety hump? Or was, I mean, you know, how did you, was this just, I'm going to throw myself into this?
I still was.
The fear went away or not?
I still was okay with everything because it was photos.
But like you know? Lost your inhibitions. You didn't have the anxiety.
I mean... I never had anxiety around my naked body because right. I never felt like my body was mine in the first place. Mm. So, like, I was always a workhorse for my family and for everything. I've had a job since I was 12 years old. I never felt like I owned my body or had a right to it, or I just never had an opinion about it. It was like having an opinion about the engine in your car. Mm. Like, who cares how it looks? It doesn't matter. You know, it's like, I just didn't feel... So I never felt feelings like shame or this or that, because it was just kind of like, I understand when people look at my tits, they feel something. I don't know what that is, and I don't really care, and it kind of doesn't really matter. Just give me money. You know, it was like I just didn't have that kind of relationship to my body. I just did. I never felt anxious about whether or not people thought I was hot or cute or, you know what I mean? Like, I just...
Okay.
You know, it felt like something that didn't belong to me, if that makes sense.
It's so like disassociative almost.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's not great.
Is it not? I feel like most women spend most of their lives being disassociative, like being dissociative because of
the attention?
Because of the way that we're groomed to exist.
Right, so you're projected upon and objectified. So
and that's kind
why
of,
not
yeah.
be disassociative?
Yeah. I mean, that's how most women are coping. I think most women are walking around in dissociative states.
So you do the bohemian art thing, and that turns, and it felt like you were part of a movement, and then what?
So around 2011, I got scouted by a feminist porn filmmaker in LA, and that was a big decision.
A woman.
Yeah, a woman. I don't want to give her air either, because she turned out to be interesting.
It's a diplomatic word. Okay.
I mean, interesting.
Yeah.
It's neutral.
Neutral.
And my feelings about her are neutral.
Okay. So you get, she scouts you
she
out.
She scouts me. And it, like, that is a big decisive moment. My adoptive father had cancer at the time. And I was flying to Fresno a lot to take care of him. And we didn't know how we were going to deal with bills. She made the offer. And it was just like, come do this and I'll try to make you a contract girl and I'll pay you $1,000 per scene. And at the time I'd been living off of my modeling work in New York, and I was like, $1,000 per scene to me was like a lot of fucking money.
Now, what makes it feminist? Was it all girl?
That's up for debate in our industry. I think it just means that the woman's holding the camera.
Okay. okay.
But so I started doing girl, and my thought at the time was like, I'll do a few movies and I'll take the money and I'll go to bum around Europe and do that. Like, this, my whole life has been like trying to get to the same weird place
where you can just walk around Europe.
Yeah. So I signed on to do it, and like I just kind of became popular. You know, I was a really popular girl performer. I only worked with women, and it was this time when we were making really artsy stuff, and we were making a lot of features, and it turned out I was a good actress.
Yeah.
And a lot of the movies at the time were features. They had scripts and stories, and there was this feeling that we were making art. It was just kind of radical, and that this is about to be this new kind of era of cinema where there was going to be this sort of synergy. Because you have to think that at the same time that Gaspar Noé was coming out with stuff, Sasha Grey was doing mainstream movies, there was a feeling that there was this moment where maybe like these
porn
two worlds...
Porn was going to break legit?
Well, yeah. Or these worlds might collide and live harmoniously together.
Yeah.
And in some ways that's come true. I mean, being a porn star has now become its own unique kind of celebrity in a way that it wasn't before. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be like, well, she used to do porn and now she's this. Now porn stars in and of themselves are legitimate celebrities. I mean, they're now like rappers and musicians, where for them it's a brag to say that their girlfriend is a porn star. It's
I get that
wild.
But like, you know, you're still up against, you know, like how, like, we don't have to go through the whole porn experience, but I mean, now that you want to get out of it, because what was this point where you thought it was going to break legit? Then, like, by the time I met you, you were like, I'm just doing girl on girl. I want out.
Yeah.
You know,
let me clarify. I never gave a fuck. I was trying to survive. But the photographer had a vision. I never cared about any of that stuff.
Okay. But,
you know what I mean?
But
like,
what I'm saying is
care.
That it became your job.
It became
right?
a job. Yeah.
And there, that once you were able to, you know, at post-pandemic and sort of before the pandemic, when you were kind of started doing the stand-up, that, you know, you still were up against the fact that celebrity or not, being a porn person was sort of a liability in the legit world.
To a degree. Honestly, people have always asked, do your parents know what you do, or what did your parents think? And that question's always funny to me, because like I never even think of my parents as like thinking of me, like at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so it's like I was like, why would I tell them? They wouldn't care. Like, why would they care what I was doing? Like, it doesn't even enter my headspace that like they think of me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The only people I asked was I asked all my friends that were writers that were working in publishing. I was like, if I do this, is it going to impact my career?
And
they said, oh no, it's going to help it. They were like, it's like that Robert Anton Wilson thing, which is like, my advice to a young writer is involve yourself in some scandal.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to get published.
Well, does that turn out to be true though, ultimately?
It has, because when I look back at everything that I have, if I hadn't been in porn, I wouldn't have gotten anyone's attention.
Because you were you're writing for that magazine, what is it?
I write for Mel Magazine, but I mean, even before that, when I was doing stand up, or when I had the podcast, I knew that the reason I was able to get guests was because they wanted to come hang out with a porn star for an hour, and then they got in the door and they were like, oh, it's actually just a podcast. But that's how I kind of got into stand-up, though, was because those people, some of them were like that, and then a lot of those people became friends and were like,
the comics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were like,
give it a whirl.
Yeah. A lot, like, I kind of was... What made it awesome, because by the time I started doing stand-up, no one gave me a hard time because everyone thought it was their idea.
Yeah.
Like, everyone thought they were the one that had told me I should do it. So I was able to kind of circumvent a lot of the, like, oh, a porn star that thinks she can do stand-up. I was able to circumvent a lot of that because all of the comics that I was around were like, yeah, I told her she should do it.
Yeah.
You know, they all thought they were the one.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's just like, you know, you wrote a script that's getting some attention. And you're actively engaged in the process of maybe bringing it to life in mainstream show business.
Yeah.
In a big way. So where were you when you wrote that script? Because like I said, like, since I've known you, you've been sort of like one foot in the business. But like, and I also knew that it was a means of survival, and that after a certain point, the reality is it becomes difficult for you to like get any sort of like, non-celebrity job without being investigated somehow and judged, right? So, and that's an obstacle, whether you think it's a moral issue or whether it bothers you or not, right? You've had to deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's everything. It's I can get kicked out of my apartment. I've had bank accounts closed. I cannot date. It makes literally everything a challenge.
And
there's no aspect of life that is not profoundly impacted by doing this job. And that's the thing that as much as we're talking about, here's my, I'll do this one rant for 30 seconds. My gripe about this normalization of sex workers' rights is like, the thing about sex workers' rights was about drawing attention to the fact that our job is a site of labor. It has never meant to glamorize what it is. And that has become conflated. Like, when we're talking about having rights, it's like we want people to recognize that what we do is labor and we deserve rights and protections, just like everybody else. We deserve to not be discriminated against. We deserve to be protected from public health diseases and things like that. We deserve to be safe from police harassment and job discrimination, right? Yeah. Like, these are just basic protections right. that should be in place because we are a legitimate site of labor. That's different from like whether or not this is a fun or good job or that something that's good for everybody
or even your personal feelings about you in relation to it.
Exactly. Yeah. This has nothing to do with whether or not porn addiction is real, sex addiction is real, whether or not human trafficking exists. Like, all of that is separate.
It's a job.
It's like, at the end of the day, the majority of women engaged and men engaged in sex work are there willingly and have a clientele that has sought them out. We do not create the demand. We fulfill it.
Yeah.
Right. So even though I'd been through graduate school and life, and I thought I comprehended how the stigma would impact the rest of my life, I had no fucking idea. I couldn't have comprehended how profoundly like it impacts everything. And I think it's been devastating in my personal life, especially because of the kind of the attitudes that people come into it with. You know, it's like having dating or really everything is impossible. So I started in adult in July of 2011. And the first year was really fun because it was just so different. So I was meeting all these crazy people. I went to my first AVN show. I was sort of like a contract. I wasn't an official contract girl, but I was sort of, you know, sort of the brand ambassador, if you will, of a company. I was getting scripts wrote around me. It was all very thoughtful. I was acting. I was, you know, like all of the things. It was very exciting and fun. And then by 2012, 2013, it was like just starting to, that relationship had finally dissipated. And I finally found myself for the first time as a grown up, like kind of just a free agent. Without emotional responsibility to anybody. And I was already starting to see the limitations of the job. It's like, it's not the most intellectually stimulating work you can do.
Yeah.
So the novelty of it had compensated for that at first. And then once the novelty of the job wore off, I was like, okay, but like, what am I really going to do, right? Like, this is fun, but what am I really going to do?
And this is around the time you started stand-up?
Almost. So that was like 2013, 2014. I had met this photographer, Richard Avery, that was like, well, you're blisteringly smart. For branding, you should have a podcast because you being on Twitter, these different places, because he had seen my Twitter and my pictures and he's like, you're really funny and all that stuff. He's like, you need a podcast. Like, that's going to be the best branding for you. You need a format where you can sit and talk and people can hear how intelligent you are because that's your brand. And that was like kind of the first time I'd been around someone that was like, I'm going to tell you what you are.
Right.
He was like, here's what you are. You're a really fucking smart bohemian girl that does sexy times sometimes, but like, that's just because she's a bohemian. That's your brand. Yeah. That's who you are.
Right.
And I took it and ran with it. I was like, okay. And so with the podcast, I was like, I'd always loved comedy, had been fascinated by stand-up, but didn't know how to do it. And so with the podcast, I was like, why don't I just interview comedians?
Right.
Like, that'll make it, it'll two birds with one stone. Like, I'll kind of figure out how they got to do it.
That's why I interview actors. You can figure it out. Get free lessons.
Also, I just was like, I didn't want the podcast to be like boring, right? I was like, I'll just have the comedians on, and then, and so I went and like looked up a list of like top up and coming comedians, and I messaged them all on Twitter, and they all agreed to come on the fucking show.
Sure.
So it's like, it's funny. I had like Willie Hunter and Drew Michael, and like
there's been like
Kyle Kinane, and like I had like all of these people like came on.
There's been a relationship between comedy and porn for a long time.
Well, because you like we invented you guys. That's why.
Okay.
Well, no, because of vaudeville. In the vaudeville days, the host would bring on the burlesque girls.
Right.
And then eventually that became stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
So it's been a lifelong.
Sure.
Like, we both exist kind of together.
Yeah.
But so so I was doing that, and that's, and then some of my comic friends were like, you know, you should try it. I started doing stand-up around 2015, and you and I had just become friends, and I also met a girl that became my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And she was a fan. She had started as a fan. I'd never done that before. But she had been buying Skype shows for me, and she was so stunningly fucking beautiful. I couldn't believe it. And she was so smart. What I recognize now is that she was also traumatized in very much the same way that I was as a child by a mom that was kind of emotionally incestuous.
Yeah.
Just kind of like just too much.
Yeah.
Just too much all the time, unpredictable, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, of course we got along swimmingly at first, but that also was the same thing that ended up becoming, you know, like two magnets that have the same charge. It's like,
yeah,
I triggered her anxious attachment. She triggered my avoidant attachment. Like, you know, it just kind of.
But that went on for a while.
It went on for 3 years.
Yeah.
But she kind of saw that I was tired, and she came in and very, she worked in tech, and her work paid really well.
Yeah.
And after we'd been together for a little while, I think what triggered it was I couldn't fit into a pair of pants, and I had a photo shoot, and I had like a meltdown where I was like a full on, I'm going insane meltdown.
Yeah.
And she was like, you need to take a break. Like, this job is killing you.
Yeah.
Like, this, like, and she basically was like, why don't I cover the bills and just focus on stand up? And you've been wanting to write this novel, like, and you finish the novel, let's have a deal. Like, let me just get your back for a little while. Cause like, I think you're going to lose your mind. I think you're going insane. And I think you need a break. And so I ended up taking about a year off. I did finish a draft of the French Revolution novel, and I did a lot of stand-up. I ended up doing a cross-country tour with Aaliyah Janine. And by the time I got back from that, me and the girlfriend, the relationship had just reached a point of like, it was like an open relationship, but there was a lot of just emotional infidelity going on. I was doing it too. Like, I got wrapped up in this guy that was like a professor, and she was wrapped up in this girl that was you know what I mean? Like, there was like, it just kind of got to this point where it was like, we're roommates now. Like, we're not, there's nothing is connecting us.
Yeah.
And I think too, it was just like both of us realizing that we were just trauma bonded, and just triggering each other like over and over and over again.
So it's so hard, the trauma bonded thing.
Oh, yeah. So we broke up, and I was kind of didn't know if I wanted to do stand up. This relationship had failed. I didn't want to be in porn anymore. Like, there was a lot going on. And one night I think you and I had a discussion around this time where I was kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And you had said something to me around like, you need to be more strategic. Like, you don't have any strategy around kind of what you're doing. And it had never occurred to me that a career path might have strategy.
Yeah.
Well, people always think I'm really smart, so they assume that I understand a lot of stuff that for them is very basic.
Yeah.
And it's like they don't understand that I'm autistic. It's like it's a very.
Well, I wasn't either. I learned it just from, like, you know, chaos.
Well, anyway, you gave me that hot tip.
Good.
And I don't remember if it was you or someone else, but someone had said something like, well, if you need to get on TV, and if you want to get on TV, you either do your 5 minutes for late night or you write a TV sitcom and you make a vehicle for yourself. But those are the ways you do it. And like, you get on TV, and then once you're on TV, then you can go on tour and do the thing. Right?
Sure. The standard comic Bible.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I went home one night, got really drunk.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, upset about everything.
Yeah.
And I wrote this pilot in about 4 hours that is what I'm, the one
involved
that you did the table
now.
Read
yeah.
Yeah, for. Like, and then I put it in a drawer and forgot about it because I didn't have anyone to give it to. And I got done with it and I was like, this is neither a sitcom nor good. Mm. And like, nor is it fun. It just seemed like.
You needed to get it out.
Yeah. And that was just that thing where I was like, okay, well, now I have my TV pilot. So if anyone ever asks, I have it.
Yeah.
And I, like, went back into, I started getting writing gigs and went back into doing adults, but with this mind towards to keep accruing the writing gigs.
And also the adult at this point is like, you know, you have almost complete control over it.
Yeah, because it's like OnlyFans and stuff like that. Yeah. So I'm back in adult and I'm accruing writing gigs and working on stuff with this idea that I'll finally be able to transition out by kind of just waiting till the writing gigs just start accruing more money than the adult.
Right.
And I ended up writing, and then we went under into a pandemic. We had a little Pamplemousse.
Little
Panda Express, little Panera. And my OnlyFans started doing really, really well enough that for the first time I could completely just stay home and not work. And I started writing extra hard. And I became a columnist for Mel Magazine, and I was doing other subsidiary stuff and just really focused on, by the time the pandemic was over, I wanted to just be completely done with adults. Like, basically for that whole year, I didn't do any adult shoots at all. But I, like, officially retired. But I did the thing where I called the agent, and I just was like, you know, 10 years is a long time, and I think I'm done. And
he was like, great.
He's like, okay, well, I was honored to be able to help and be part of what you're doing, and I know you're going to really do amazing things. And it was kind of cool. A friend I was with, like, unbeknownst to me, had gathered all of these people that I'd worked with for 10 years and made me a video that was like, whatever. Oh, like, it was like I was sobbing. It was so beautiful. Sweet. And I kind of did this, like, I don't believe in affirmations or manifesting or astrology or tarot cards, but I do find that shit soothing as fuck. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So I just find it calming.
Yeah.
But I really started doing like affirmations and manifesting and kind of focusing and reading a lot of self-help stuff and like really just going hard and taking this leap of faith that like if I got rid of the safety net that other shit would happen. And then in March of this year, Peter Berg slid into my DMs and was like, I read an article you wrote and do you want to talk?
Yeah.
And everything since then has been kind of insane. But the moral of the story is it's a good thing I had that pilot.
Yeah.
Because I met him and we were talking. And then I was like, well, I did write a TV pilot. And he was like, well, let me see it. And a week later, I pulled it out. I like refurbished it a little bit. And a week later, he had it in his hands. And I think that the fact that I was on deck like that probably had more of a positive impact on that relationship than anything else. It's like, because it just demonstrated out the gate that like,
you can do the work.
Or just that like, no one has ever been more prepared for an opportunity than me.
Yeah, I
swear to God.
And then now we're going to be at this weird place where it's like, we're going to all be waiting.
Yeah.
To see what happens.
Yeah. I feel that it cannot fail.
Good.
I don't know how confident I feel in what we've done here today.
I just think it's a great sort of story to tell personally from your experience and also like, you know, paying your dues in these different areas in life, you know, with hardship, with trauma, you know, and doing the work that you did and understandably getting tired of it after a certain point, but not necessarily being ashamed of it.
I'm not ashamed of anything I've done.
Well, there you go.
Like, ever, you know. And I think that's, if we're talking about harm reduction, like, we have to stop stigmatizing the people that do this work. Like, that is the biggest area of harm reduction. It's not the Swedish model. It's not arresting Johns. It's not banning porn. It's not any of that. It is getting rid of the stigma that sex workers have to face. It makes it impossible for them to leave. It makes it, you know, it creates so many problems that create these scenarios in which people have to make really desperate decisions or have to do desperate things to cope. And it's like the stigma. Like
the suicides have happened a lot in the last few years.
I mean, it's just, so much of it is around like all these civilians, like, I would never do porn. Like, people will treat you like shit. And it's like, who are the people? Like, the call's coming from inside the house. Like, you're the one doing the harm. Like, that's you.
Yeah.
You know, you could stop at any time by simply withdrawing your participation in that process. So I think the stigma is the most harmful thing. And I'm absolutely not ashamed of anything that I've done at all. But, you know, it's just time to move on.
And yeah, you seem grounded in that.
Yeah.
Ready.
I mean, I finally gave up OnlyFans. That was like the last little.
Yeah.
That was like the last. I was like the vestigial tail. Yeah. Like,
see you later.
Bye.
Thank you.
So it's like now it's a full.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Good talking to you.
Oh, should I say something?
No. There you go. Again, you can see all things Sovereign related at sovereignsire.net. Also, don't forget, I have tour dates and some have been added. And I know I told you about these. I'm going to do these occasionally. So people who want to come see me can come see me. Comedy Works in Denver, August 5th, 6th, and 7th. Stand Up Live in Phoenix, August 12th. And added a show on August 13th. Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, August 19, 20, and 21. Helium in St. Louis, Missouri, September 16, 17, and 18. The Comedy Attic in Bloomington, September 30, October 1, and October 2. Okay, that's where we're at right now. I'm looking into adding more shows at Dynasty Typewriter here in Los Angeles. And there might be some things added as I move through and continue to work on this. And I will tell you, it's been exciting. It's been exciting riffing out this hour because my process of discovery is being witnessed by these audiences at Dynasty, and they're seeing shows they will never see again. They may never happen like they did the night they saw them again as I try to hone in on this stuff. But that feeling of sort of like, what just happened? Where did that come from? Is happening, and it will continue happening. So if I'm going to be near you, come see me. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets, links to tickets. Okay, good. Now, moving on. Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.